Matt Bubala here with you on Radio 720 WGN. Today marked the end of an important chapter in Chicago media history. Blair Kamen, Chicago's Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune since 1992, took a buyout offer, you know, in this media world that we have these days. Things are getting cut back all over, and the Trib had a round of buyouts, and unfortunately, some very prominent names accepted them, and one of them is our very own Blair Kamen, who's been kind enough to join us on the phone tonight. Hey, Blair, how are you?
Good, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for doing this. I know that you had your last day at the paper today, and so I promise myself this isn't my last interview with you. I will wrangle you into doing things no matter where you end up in the future, but I really wanted to get you on the show one more time as the Tribune architecture critic. I guess it doesn't expire, I would say, until midnight tonight, so we're still good for a little bit here. But I wanted to ask you to reflect upon the years at the paper and some of the current things going on in Chicago, as well as the future. So let's, you know, you and I have never done this before. I always ask you about current things, but I've been looking into your history a little bit and watched a little bit of a Chicago Tonight interview from many years ago and heard the story about when you first critiqued something in Des Moines. I don't think you were probably fully an architecture critic back in the day. How did you come upon the architecture beat? How did that become yours?
It became mine because I took a class in college in Gothic architecture, and I had a wonderful professor, Joel Upton, who really brought alive the great cathedrals of medieval France, like Chartres and Notre Dame in Paris. He really showed that, you know, the great synthesis of art and technology that these buildings represented, and he also looked at them as cultural artifacts. If you can understand these buildings, you can understand the culture that built them. That's really what got me going, and I had to decide whether I wanted to be a practicing architect or write about it, and ultimately I chose the latter.
Have you ever thought, man, I should have been an architect, I should have been designing these buildings, not just commenting on them?
No. When I was in graduate school at Yale, I once made a drawing of an urban space, you know, not like an outdoor park, and one of the other students said, not in a cutting way, but just like in an offhanded way, "Oh, that looks like naive art." So I knew I'd made the right choice.
So you went into journalism right away. Your first job was I can't imagine it. Every small, you know, in any media business, generally you have to start out somewhere small and work your way up. And I can't imagine most smaller newspapers or places are saying, what we really need is an architecture critic. How did you start right away writing about architecture? Or did you write about whatever you had to with the goal of getting to architecture?
No, I didn't start as an architecture critic. My father, Art Kamen, actually was the editor and president of a small newspaper in New Jersey. It was called the Daily Register, and it was the newspaper in the Red Bank, New Jersey area, essentially the Jersey Shore. So I got started in journalism serving coffee on election night in my dad's newspaper. I was a summer intern. My first published stories were obituaries that I wrote, and I would like go to the beach at the shore, you know, the morning after I wrote the obituaries, rip open the paper to the obituaries that I had written. I was so thrilled to see something I had written in print. So that's how I got my start. And then gradually, you know, I had internships, and I worked in Des Moines after graduate school at the Des Moines Register, a very fine newspaper. But I worked there for 3 years before coming to the Tribune as a reporter in 1987.
And was it the same thing in Des Moines? Just started obituaries, you're probably covering local city meetings, whatever that they throw your way as you worked your way up?
Well, by the time I started in Des Moines, I was doing both reporting for the most part, but also architecture criticism.
Okay.
And they hired me because they knew that I could do both. And the story that you referenced had to do with Richard Meyer, a Pritzker Prize-winning architect, who designed a new wing for the Des Moines Art Museum. He had just won the Pritzker. He designed this addition to a building that already had wings by two very distinguished architects, Elio Sarnen and I.M. Pei. And he came to town and read my review, which basically panned the building. And he said at the opening, and I know this because the Associated Press recorded it, he said, is this guy? And the associate director of the museum said, speaking of me, nobody, he's nobody. So ever since then, I've had a mug on my desk with the words nobody taped with the word nobody taped onto it.
Well, we all start somewhere, and starting out as nobody is not the worst thing in the world. Do you look back upon that piece that you wrote, and did it hold up? Do you feel like, you know what, I was pretty spot on, or do you look back and say, man, I was young at the time and I was a little brash? Or how do you reflect upon the older work?
Well, and that with that particular piece, there are things definitely that I would have changed in, you know, in retrospect, and I won't go into all the details, but sure. I mean, like, I guess that's my juvenilia, you know, as people say, right?
Sure.
Des Moines was a great place to start because I really learned the craft of journalism. I worked with some tremendous editors and reporters there. And got a chance to, you know, learn the craft and also to make mistakes, not factual mistakes, but, you know, mistakes of emphasis and judgment in some cases. And I also was very lucky because when I got to Chicago, I was a reporter here for 5 years before I became the architecture critic. My mentor was Paul Gapp, who was the Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic. And he really brought me along and let me do stories like a magazine piece about the renovation of Frank Lloyd Wright's Dana Thomas House in Springfield, or the review of what was then called New Comiskey Park, which I panned, and definitely that
held up.
Yeah, that definitely held up. I mean, that really was an important piece. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I was very lucky that the Tribune really brought me along and, you know, helped paved the way for me to do what I've done for the last 28 years.
For those first 5 years, it sounds like you were writing about architecture, but you were also a reporter. What other types of things were you covering at the time?
My first beats were covering Naperville and Aurora, the two super suburbs in the far west in DuPage and Kane counties. I then did what was called the Suburban Affairs beat, which was kind of a region-wide beat. I don't know, it made it sound like I was covering, you know, Peyton Place type romances out there in the land of cul-de-sacs. And then I did arts coverage, arts reporting, the culture beat for about a year before I became the architecture critic in 1992.
So you were the architecture critic then for 28 years, won the Pulitzer in 99. It's a very long, storied career. So I've got a lot of different questions to ask about that. One is, every time I have you on, almost every time, I'm asking you about the skyscrapers in the city or something really in the city center, in River North or the Magnificent Mile or something about the, you know, the Art Hall buildings. And outside of asking you about the Obama Center, I can't think of anything else I've asked of you outside of probably like a 6 to 7 mile radius. But there's so much more to Chicago. What do we not talk about enough when it comes to Chicago and architecture outside of the things that tourists want to talk about?
Well, the most important things really are the public spaces, not only on the lakefront, but also the parkland in the off lakefront areas. The quality of the business districts, which is Mayor Lightfoot is trying to revive, particularly on the south and west sides, and the housing stock. The city is much more than just that beautiful strip along the lakefront. And throughout my career, I mean, you know, yes, I've definitely focused on downtown because that's the chief area of interest for our readers.
Sure.
But, you know, I've tried to do things out in the neighborhoods. And certainly the series of articles on the Chicago lakefront in 1998, which pointed out the awful disparity between the North Lakefront, largely white and affluent, and the South Lakefront, largely black and poor, shown a spotlight on a real problem. And that has led to, you know, I'm very proud to say, urban plans for comprehensive plans for those areas and the spending of really hundreds of millions of dollars in public funds that have, you know, really changed that gap with new parkland, piers, fishing piers, beaches, amenities, other things, pedestrian bridges that have really upgraded the South Lakefront. So Yeah, there are many other things in the neighborhoods too, but that's probably the thing I'm proudest of, that particular series of articles and the many follow-ups that have been written in the 22 years since.
And still a long way to go. I would imagine that while the parkland and everything has maybe been beautified or made more accessible, the areas have still suffered greatly economically. And so there's still a long way to go there, right?
Yeah. Although, I mean, there's been a lot of progress in neighborhoods just to the west of the area called Burnham Park. That's the part of the lakefront directly south of McCormick Place. There's a lot of very nice new housing and renovated housing in those areas. That's not to say that they're completely out of the woods when it comes to, urban violence and other problems. But there has really been a discernible improvement in those areas as well as the lakefront to the east of them. And I think the two are related because, those areas are much more attractive if it's easier to get to the lakefront and enjoy the lakefront once you're there.
Sure. Talk to me a little bit more. You mentioned housing. Chicago is a city of old Chicago bungalows and different styles of housing that when money comes to an area, that's small. And that's not as valuable as a three flat or something new and modern and sleek. Are you concerned about, I mean, I imagine that happens and that's going to happen, but are we doing enough to preserve the history of the architecture of Chicago when it comes to the housing?
I would say in some cases, yes. Like the Historic Chicago Bungalow Initiative has been a very successful effort at, maintaining this very valuable housing stock. But clearly, this gentrification has cut a very double-edged sword in areas like, the Northwest Side, the near Northwest Side around the 606 Bloomingdale Trail. I mean, there you've got older housing stock that is very affordable and has multiple units in it, giving way to, large, very expensive single-family homes, and you've got widespread displacement of people occurring. And this is really the same problem that popped up in Pilsen, where recently the city tried and failed to create a landmark district. Residents there did not think the landmark district was the answer to the displacement and gentrification that was occurring. So, it's an ongoing problem, without a doubt, and the city is much more than the shiny towers of downtown. You can have a vibrant, functioning city unless you have healthy neighborhoods, and that I'm really glad to say that Mayor Lightfoot recognizes that. She has hired a really smart planning commissioner, Maurice Cox, who is working on the Invest Southwest program to try to revive business districts throughout the South and West Sides. And he's off to a good start, but it's really too early to tell whether this program will bear fruit. I hope it does, but it's going to take a long time, a generation or more, to undo the damage that's been done by redlining and disinvestment and gun violence. It's a big, big turn of the aircraft carrier that Lightfoot and Cox are trying to achieve, and it's going to take a long time to do it.
There's so much, when it comes to people moving into the city, people living in the city, transportation is so important because it's such a big area and you've got to still be able to get around, and it's much easier if people don't necessarily have to have cars. Is the city doing enough? I know this gets a little more into planning than architecture, but is the city doing enough of marrying the building with the transportation needs and planning that out and keeping that, so that we don't get over congested in certain ways?
There have been some advances in that area. Rahm Emanuel in particular was very strong on transportation, and really, under him, there was renovation of the Red Line, the Brown Line, and notably some very handsome transit stations were completed. The Millennium, the Washington Wabash Station, became like a gateway to Millennium Park, and there were many others. Carol Ross Barney, a very fine architect, did a really, really handsome station, a tube-like station that it serves as a gateway to McCormick Place. And she also did the Morgan Station on the Green Line that is a gateway to the gentrifying area on the Near West Side. So at the same time, there are still big challenges. The extension of the Red Line further south past 95th Street is a big issue, one that, you know, is really needed to provide access to jobs, an opportunity, economic opportunity for people on the far south side. So it's a mixed story. You know, there are some good things and some not so, and some things still very much on the civic agenda that really need to be accomplished.
Well, going a little bit hand in hand with that, part of having a city and an open lakefront is the accessibility to get around, not just by transportation, but by enjoying the city mm-hmm. itself. In that way, I guess, there have been a lot of trails, the 606 certainly the most famous, but other trails mm-hmm. that are connecting parts of the city more and more. Mm-hmm. Are we happy with how those are turning out and how those blend in with the city and join the city together?
Well, I mean, the 606 has been a fascinating and fraught development. It was part of Emanuel's push to take anachronistic facilities from the industrial age, whether it be an old rail line that supplied, you know, businesses and factories, like as the 606 was, or Migs Field, and turn them into parkland because they were essentially outmoded. So the problem with the 606 was that everyone thought it would be a great thing because it would bring open space, much needed open space, to areas where that could easily be described as park deserts, like food deserts. They just didn't have a lot of open space, and this was a way to alleviate that problem. You know, but no one really thought about the consequences of doing this. And that's what, you know, once the 606 went in, all these landlords moved in, they bought up property, they tore down homes, and, you know, that led to the gentrification I discussed earlier. So one of the things in the future that's really important is anticipating the consequences of improved public spaces and ensuring that, the very people who those spaces are supposed to help are not hurt by them. So that's going to be a challenge in the future for the city. You know, you want good development, you know, good parkland to go hand in hand with improving communities, not, you know, forcing people out.
There is an incredible amount of lakefront property south of the Museum of mm-hmm. Science and Industry. I forget what the site is yeah. called. Is it the Steelworks site, or I'm thinking?
Yeah, Southworks.
The Southworks.
It's the old U.S. steel plant.
The old U.S. steel plant. A lot of what could be incredibly beautiful lakefront property. And I know yeah. that it's been debated back and forth, and plans have been made. I don't know if anything is even set right now or where that is all at. What do you hope for? I mean, that's property that's kind of once in a lifetime property for the city to figure out what really should happen there. Is that going to be done well by planners, or is the city keeping control of what happens there? Or are you worried about that?
Well, U.S. Steel, based in Pittsburgh, still owns the property, and they, they have been not exactly great owners and stewards of that land in terms of seeing that it's developed. That property, Southworks, is bigger in size than the Loop. It's enormous, and it's an enormous place on which you could paint a vision of the post-industrial future. There have been tremendous plans for that area, and they've come to like zip, nothing. So I don't know, you know, I can't give you a prediction on when, if and when that's going to develop. Clearly, though, there may well be issues of, you know, environmental remediation.
Sure.
And that could add to the cost and even potentially the legal risk for a developer. But it's been really dispiriting to see the city take. I mean, it's 22 years since I wrote the series on the lakefront and said this was, you know, a great site for development, and you know, it's as close to the loop as Evanston, I think. You know, the far north side, and yet it's just sitting there. So it's an enormous, you know, it's a great opportunity for affordable housing to improve the lakefront. You know, it's all these things, and yet no one can seem to unlock its potential. It's enormously frustrating. And meanwhile, there are other things like the Michael Reese site at 31st and Lakeshore Drive. Those seem to be cooking at least. So there's some hope. But Southworks, man, it's been frustrating.
Yeah, and it seems like just a missed opportunity for such beautiful area and such beautiful land. We're speaking with Blair Kamen. He is the Chicago Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic, only for a few more minutes. And when the clock strikes 12 tonight, Blair will be moving on to other things. When we come back after the news here, I want to ask him a little bit more about some of the missed opportunities or things that are changing in Chicago, as well as his final thoughts on our great civic buildings that Chicago is known for, and what's next for Blair Kamen. We'll do that after the news, coming up right now here on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. A few more minutes with our friend Blair Kamen, Chicago Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic. Blair, when we were headed into the news, we were talking about the Southworks site and some of the missed opportunities maybe that are still needing some attention here in Chicago. We saw the old post office get redeveloped. That took a long time, and that's it happening. You said the Michael Reese site. So there are a lot of great things happening. One of the endangered buildings in Chicago for the last number of years, since Governor Rauner wanted to get rid of it, is the Thompson Center. And the Thompson Center is such a beautiful example of everything that's tough about architecture, because here's a site, an incredibly probably expensive parcel of land that has this magnificently, I would say personally, odd architecture that is a beautiful piece of something that's different in the city and makes you look up with wonder and awe, or maybe argue with a friend that, no, that's ugly, that's weird, why do we have that? I think there's 18 different ways you can go with that, and mm-hmm. You know, everybody could have a fun argument about that. But if it went away, I think it would be a shame for the city of Chicago, because it's a defining piece, and it's not the same old cookie-cutter office building that so many things unfortunately are. What are your thoughts on where the Thompson Center heads?
You said it better than I can. I think that the Thompson Center is really worth saving, despite the fact that it's had all kinds of functional problems and even some aesthetic ones over the course of its life. It's a major work of postmodern architecture, and it's a great civic space. That atrium, despite its, you know, the leaks it suffered, the overheating, the functional problems resulting from noise and smells from the atrium going into offices of state workers, those things can all be overcome quite easily. So, you know, in the same way that Chicago had wisdom to save the Chicago Cultural Center, the former public library, the old post office, and most recently Cook County Hospital, it needs to really do everything it can to block essentially what the state is doing. And, you know, trying to sell the building off to a developer who would tear it down and put something else up. I hope very much that the building is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. That would provide incentives for its financial incentives for its reuse. And I hope the city, you know, steps up to the plate and landmarks the building, again, blocking the state from doing what it wants to do with it. At the same time, I think that it's not simply an aesthetic issue. If you want to save that building, you have to come up with economically feasible plans to do so. And to their credit, you know, landmarks groups like Landmarks Illinois and Preservation Chicago have pushed plans like that. So, you know, people aren't just marching and saying, you know, save this building. like they did, you know, back in the 1960s. It's a more sophisticated version of historic preservation, and this is really a new frontier in preservation. I mean, Matt, when I started in 1992, the Thompson Center was only 7 years old, right, finished in 85, and the state just let it go to hell, you know, in the 28 years. I mean, it was kind of like a de facto demolition. You know, they say, well, the building's in terrible shape. Well, yeah, of course it's in terrible shape. They didn't take care of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that I've seen many instances where buildings supposedly were, you know, unredeemable. They, you know, I remember the Reliance building on State Street in Washington. There was once an alderman who said, you know, this building isn't worth a dime. And now, you know, it's been turned into a beautiful hotel, superb restoration. It's a gem of, you know, downtown, a great Chicago school building from the late 19th century. So I am skeptical of the voices we hear, you know, like Governor Rauner, who just said, you know, this building is you know, can't be saved. I think it can be saved as long as, you know, there's a reasonable economic plan to do so.
Talk to me a little bit about our places people see when they come to town. I'll ask you about the skyscrapers in a minute, but you mentioned that you did the review of New Comiskey Park. So we've got Guaranteed Rate Field now. We've got a Soldier Field that went over a makeover that is wonderful if you're seeing a game and really awful if you're driving by in Lakeshore Drive, I would say.
Yeah.
You have Wrigley Field, which is still sort of the same, but it's so different now. And the United Center, which is a beautiful cookie cutter of every other NBA/NHL arena in North America, but it replaced a place that was very unique and very architecturally kind of classic and loud and cramped and had all these crevices and stuff in it. Give me your two-sentence reviews of our playing field.
Yeah, the sports facility,
yeah.
Sure. Well, okay. So, you know, Soldier Field, you're right, has a wonderful athletic dynamic interior. And yes, you're also right, the you know, it's Klingon meets Parthenon on the outside, and the building was stripped of National Historic Landmark status, because when you're inside Soldier Field, you really have none of the sense of history or character that you would have had when the building was completed. So I think too that, you know, that building has enormous limitations. You can only put about 62,000 people in it. It's not domed, so you can have a Super Bowl there.
Right.
You can have, you know, the NCAA basketball tournament there. So as a result of that very kind of short-sighted decision to use Soldier Field and cram a new stadium inside of it, you know, Indianapolis has supplanted Chicago as the capital of Midwestern sports for big events. So that one, I think, you know, is not a plus. Guaranteed Rate Field, New Comiskey, the Cell, whatever you want to call it, has gotten better since it debuted in 1991. The you know, the White Sox essentially admitted that they had made a huge mistake with its, you know, way too steep and way too tall upper deck. They sheared off several rows several years ago. And it's become, you know, a better place to watch a game. The lower deck was always good. The problem with it is its urban stance. I mean, unlike Wrigley, which really is surrounded by a neighborhood and very much an urban experience, you know, Comiskey was the last of the suburban style parks, you know, surrounded by parking, not really connected to its environs. And that's always been, as well, you know, in addition to its awkward architecture, its problem. United Center, a very kind of pallid, postmodern imitation of the great stadium. Way too many skyboxes. If you're in the upper deck there, you know, you might as well be watching from the moon with binoculars. It's nowhere. I mean, it tries to replicate the noise and the excitement of the old Chicago Stadium, but, you know, it's not nowhere near the same. Wrigley is changed. There's no doubt about it. And for the most part, I mean, I wish all the signage wasn't there, but it's part of the economic reality of modern day baseball. The outside is much better than it was 25 years ago. It's been beautifully restored. There's new, public space around it. It was declared a National Historic Landmark, the very thing that was taken away from Soldier Field. All things considered in terms of the balance between aesthetics and economics, I think Wrigley has turned out pretty well. I just hope that the Ricketts family and the Cubs don't go into excess with the signage and other things that make money for them. That's the key. Going forward.
I always hope that eventually, once the Ricketts got control of all the rooftops, that they would move those two video boards out to, because the one right over the left field where that video board is, there's a roof that was never a rooftop. It was that slanted roof that always said WGN Sports or Budweiser on it all those years. And I always hope that those boards would eventually move out of the stadium and we'd get back a little bit of what was, and still they'd be able to have all the modern amenities that they want the fans to be able to see.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I wish the giant video board wasn't there. It's too big. It overshadows the center field scoreboard. It's not perfect, and it's certainly not the way I would have done it if I owned the Cubs. But, hey, I don't. the other thing that's interesting about, Wrigley is Wrigleyville. The Ricketts and just private development in general have gentrified the neighborhood. It isn't the kind of gritty urban place it once was. Is that bad? I mean, there are some people like Paul Sullivan, the Tribune's wonderful sports columnist, who have kind of derided it as River North.
Bit of Navy Pier now. It really is.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Blair. I was saying it is a little bit Navy Pier now. There's very clean, family friendly everything everywhere, and that's a good thing for everybody that comes in on a bus. But it misses being Chicago. I mean, they used to talk about moving to Rosemont or Schaumburg. We should just do this. Well, they brought Schaumburg to Wrigley Field, at least the 4-block radius.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say that. I don't think it's suburban. I think the new stuff that has gone up there is urban. The problem is that it feels a little bit new, a little bit shiny, and it's that kind of generic urbanism that, you see pretty much everywhere, the same, I don't rue the days of Yum Yum Donuts and having a giant parking lot, along Clark Street. I don't feel romantic for those days. And when Wrigley was kind of in a scruffy neighborhood, this is a problem with ballparks. I mean, the teams want to maximize revenue, and they do it by going outside the parks and by controlling, the land, the developments around it, kind of like the way, it's like what the Red Sox did with Fenway.
Right.
On the whole, I can't really fault what's been done there. I think it's better. It's more attractive. Yes. Maybe like in 20 years, it'll get a little scruffier. Okay. The shiny Schaumburg like part will wear off and, you'll still feel like you're in the city.
Blair, let's talk a little bit about the condo situation in Chicago. When I come in from the burbs and I drive into the city, I get off at Ohio, and I often marvel at all the beautiful, tall, semi-skyscrapers that are up that are condos, and they're everywhere. Here we are post-pandemic. There's a lot of concern about how many people will come into the city. Will workers come back into the city in the same way? Will residents leave the city with the tax issues that will be faced here? What's your overall take on this, what's going on with, there's continually more very large skyscrapers going up and beautiful ones. NEMA down a little south of the city is getting advertised like crazy. Of course, what's now the St. Regis is just open, and the Tribune Tower and its massive building that's eventually going to go behind it. Can the city sustain this, and are you happy overall with what you're seeing architecture-wise from all these buildings that have been going up the last 10 years?
It's a mixed story. I mean, the architecture, the general level of architecture has certainly improved from the awful Stalinist-like exposed concrete buildings that went up west of Michigan Avenue in the late 1990s and early 2000s. These were hulking structures where you'd have giant parking garages like 10 or 12 stories high at the bottom, and then, you know, plopped on top of it would be an ugly exposed concrete condo building. Just really awful stuff. So, yeah, there's been a lot of improvement in, you know, the design of these buildings. Certainly the St. Regis Chicago by Jeannie Gang and the Aqua Tower that she's done are stellar examples of very creative residential architecture. But I think the broader question really has to do is economic rather than aesthetic. The question is, you know, what will happen in the marketplace? So in the office marketplace, the reason that downtown, you know, became a commercial powerhouse, you know, you've got tons of extra space right now, and a lot of space that, you know, companies don't necessarily want because their workers are going to be, you know, are still working from home and maybe doing hybrid work in the foreseeable future. Likewise, in the apartment market, demand has fallen because downtown is no longer as much fun to work in, or, you know, people who are working downtown were working remotely, so they, like young people, moved in with their parents. I don't think young people are going to want to stay in their parents' houses after the pandemic ends. They'll probably come back. But I just don't know the future of downtown, you know, how it's all going to play out. And it's a real issue. Because if you have fewer people downtown, you have fewer people riding Metro trains and CTA trains and buses, and that means less revenue, which could mean, you know, drops in service. It also is bad for the merchants, you know, the shop owners and restaurants that depend on a very heavy downtown population. So those are real issues, you know, looking ahead. On the whole, I think downtown will recover. Downtowns have faced pandemics and other disasters before, like 9/11, and doomsayers said, you know, they were really in horrible shape, and yet they eventually recovered. I mean, remember, Millennium Park opened 3 years after 9/11, and so that, you know, should give us a certain measure of comfort that the desire to gather, the desire to, you know, concentrate people for either culture or commerce is likely to go on. But it's likely also to be different than it was in the past.
Blair, in our last few minutes, let's talk a little bit about the importance of the critic in general, and certainly when it comes to architecture. The Tribune, you've been the architecture critic for a very long time. You mentioned Paul Gapp, your predecessor, was there for a long time, also won a Pulitzer. I don't know the true importance of the architecture critic, but I feel that from what I've seen over the years, certainly in one instance would be the Trump Tower. And that I remember your first review of what was being put out as what was going to be built, and you were critical of it, and they made changes. And I don't know that those changes were based on you writing something, but I think that at a time when the newspaper was even more prominent and a critic was more prominent and heard, I think that made a real difference on the eventual finish of that building. And, you know, from my little eye, I think it looks a lot better than it originally did. The changes were really good that were made to that building. And I do worry that if the city doesn't have a watchdog saying, hey, we need to step back and think about this, if it falls a little more to dollars and cents and things like that, then like what happened with those letters being on that building, that's an eyesore for the area right down there, not because of the name on it, but because there's a name on it at that eye level. It really distracts from what's a beautiful vantage point of the city. Where do you think we're headed as far as critics in general? And you know, I know it sounds weird for me to ask you what's the importance of the critic, because I think you're going to say, well, I do feel it's important, but it really is. And I want you to expound upon what happens if we lose that voice.
Well, it's a really good question, and let me, you know, I'll answer as best I can. The critic's voice is important, not necessarily because critics can or should have the power to say, you know, I don't like this, change it. critics have agenda-setting power at their best. They can, you know, they can focus the public's attention on a given issue or a given building beforehand, before eyesores are built and are, you know, with us for decades to come. In many cases, that power, that is the limit of their power. In other words, like, I fought against Soldier Field, but, you know, Daley went ahead and built it. I couldn't stop it. But that function is really important, and bringing, you know, having a continuous dialogue about architecture is the most important thing, because it enables the public and public officials and architects and urban designers to focus on, you know, what really matters to the public. Good public spaces, good housing, good use of, you know, things like bike lanes, et cetera. So there's that. And that is part of the longer term, you know, role of the job, where you're trying to articulate a series of values rather than just dictate what should be done. So, you know, you say buildings should be good neighbors. Buildings should be built of quality materials. They should be useful, practical, functional. They should be vessels of human possibility. In other words, they should, you know, enable people to work creatively, and urban spaces should enable, you know, people from different walks of life to come together to realize that their common humanity. So, I mean, that's really, you know, what criticism is about. And I mean, I'm so gratified right now that I'm being inundated with emails from readers who are saying, you know, thank you so much for opening our eyes to buildings and urban spaces in the city, and for, you know, we might not have noticed otherwise. So that educational role is just really important, in addition to the watchdog role. And, you know, you add on things like an interpreter's role. I mean, buildings express who we are. So, like, you know, you can really understand the muscular industrial age Chicago better by looking at the John Hancock Center, or the former John Hancock Center, or the Willis Tower, just as you could those Gothic skyscrapers, you know, Gothic cathedrals that I looked at. They were the key to understanding medieval France. So, you know, what's the future? I don't know. It's very important to me that criticism continue in Chicago. Chicago needs a full-time architecture critic to be a skyline watchdog, to report on the news, all these things. So I'm hopeful that either in the Tribune or in some other media outlet, you know, the business of architecture criticism, the practice of architecture criticism, I should say, will go on. I don't know exactly how this is going to play out, and I don't know even if, you know, there will be a full-time critic. I'm hopeful, based on some of the interested parties I've talked to, but there are no guarantees.
Blair, we really appreciate all of your time, as always. I won't bug you about what your future is. I'll let you finish out the day first, and then we'll harass you about that in the weeks to come. I'll let you sleep in one morning and not be on deadline for once. Is that something that, all in all, you have to say you can look forward to for a little bit?
Yeah, that and a lot of bike rides along Chicago's lakefront. That's going to keep a smile on my face, absolutely.
Blair Kamen, he still is the Pulitzer Prize winning, you can't take that away, architecture critic for the last 28 years at the Chicago Tribune. Thank you so much for everything, Blair. We look forward to speaking to you again very soon.
Matt, thank you so much. It's been a real delight to talk to you now and many times before.
We've got news coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom next on 720 WGN.